Hello and welcome back, listeners, to the first podcast of 2021. Today we have on Professor Eric Segal, who is the Ash Family Chair Professor of Law at Georgia State. He teaches federal courts and constitutional law. He is also the author of books Originalism as Faith and Supreme Myths. And I really enjoyed today's discussion, and I hope you do as well.
All right. Good morning and welcome, Professor Segal. For our first question, if you were responsible for drafting the articles of impeachment against President Trump, what would they be?
Article 1 would be incitement to insurrection. Article 2 would be abuse of office by unlawfully trying to coerce the Georgia Secretary of State to change votes. And I might add a third article that the sum of his public statements as, I'm not sure about this, but I might have a third article that if you look at his Twitter statements about the election, they amount to an abuse of office.
If someone was to make the argument that having just a simpler focus with just on incitement, and that's obviously what they did. They didn't focus on the call with the Georgia Secretary of State, that just making it simple and clear is a better approach. What would you have to say to that?
They didn't make it simple and clear because the evidence they put in for the incitement piece, I'm not sure it's in the speech alone, just the speech. Now, I have very smart progressive friends, like my friend Mike Dorf, among others, who think that speech, you know, is probably enough for an impeachable incitement charge and maybe, you know, maybe even a criminal charge. I don't think that speech, if you just read the speech standing alone, no. It takes a lot of other context and background. And I'm not sure that context and background is well set out in the articles of impeachment.
Yeah, another quick question. Obviously, the first impeachment was more partisan than this one is going to be. None of the impeachment managers are Republican, yet 10 Republican representatives voted to impeach him. Do you think it was a mistake for Pelosi to wait before seeing if she could get a Republican representative to become an impeachment manager or not?
I apologize. I don't know when this was announced. Who are the impeachment managers? I haven't heard of it. I haven't seen that news story.
The only one I can remember is Representative Raskin, and the only reason the only reason I remember it is because somebody who I follow. Do you know who Luke Thompson is?
No.
He's like a GOP political operative and whatnot. He helps with campaigns and stuff. And needless to say, he wasn't happy about that because I believe Representative Raskin was one of the people who objected to the electoral count in 2016.
Hold on a second. Hold on. I should, first of all, when I said Jamie's a good friend, I should say, he's a friend, but I actually used his office for a semester at American because he had cancer and he had to leave in a hurry and they needed a federal courts con law guy. And they asked me and I fit in. Representative Raskin is one of the most decent people I know. He has tremendous integrity. I don't see anything wrong with him being a manager. But I'm a little confused by, and tragically, his son just died. So it's all terrible. But I do have a question. When you said managers, are these the people going to the Senate or you mean the managers who did this stuff for the House?
I believe they're the people going to the Senate. Yes.
So to answer your question, which I ducked for the last 5 minutes, I think they should have tried everything to get one or two Republicans on that team. And I agree with you that would have been better.
Gotcha. And then the next question I have also on impeachment, can they continue the impeachment proceedings and then into the trial in the Senate after President Trump leaves office, or do you not think that the Constitution allows them to disbar him after he leaves office.
Right. So I think Bruce Ackerman at Yale and Judge, one of Scalia's clerks, judges.
Ludig.
Yeah, Ludig. Was he a Scalia clerk? I don't know. But I know he loves Scalia. They both wrote that in very definitive ways, you can't impeach someone after they leave office. That's just ridiculous. The Constitution is silent on this question. The Supreme Court would never touch it. So whether mm-hmm. you can impeach someone after they leave office or not is up to Congress. And I think obviously you can, because if you couldn't, somebody could resign the day before. And then the idea of barring them from ever running public office again wouldn't work, you know, in the impeachment process. So it doesn't really matter what I think, and it doesn't really matter what Bruce Ackerman thinks or any judge, because no Article III judge in a real case is going to second guess the decision to impeach someone after they leave office.
Gotcha. And then my last question about the current moment. Do you believe that if President Trump tried, that he could pardon himself?
So the Constitution is silent on this. This is one I think a court might take, because especially this court, because mm-hmm. there's a principle that goes all the way back to, I don't know, the 17th century, maybe before that, that everybody agrees with, that you can't be a judge in your own case. And that's not exactly the same, but it's very, very close to the same. You can't decide whether you pardon yourself for the same reasons you can't be a judge in your own case. And that non-textual common law rule is not one that is controversial, right? We all agree as a general rule, you can't be a judge in your own case. Well, that's what a self-pardon is.
Gotcha. And then moving on to more general themes, what are the reforms that you think the Supreme Court needs? Do you think it needs to have 18-year-long term limits, maximum age? Do you think it needs to be expanded to have an even number of justices from each party? Jurisdiction stripping? I mean, there's a plethora of options. Which do you think are needed?
Well, I'm in favor of anything that makes the court weaker, because the court is way too strong. It plays a role in our country that, for whatever it's worth, the founding fathers never anticipated. Alexander Hamilton talked about striking down laws only when there's an irreconcilable variance. And of course, that's not our system at all, or even close. So as I said, when Justice Scalia died and before the 2016 election, when all the liberals, like my good friend, Erin Chemerinsky, who really is a good friend, and my good friend, Mark Tushnet, who's also a really good friend, we're writing op-eds and editorials about how great the new liberal court is going to be and how we're going to do this and that and the other thing once Hillary wins. At the time, I wrote op-eds in the New York Times, Daily Beast, Huffington Post, then wrote a law review article for a symposium at Pepperdine that we should have frozen the court at 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats for all time. I had a statutory proposal that I set forth in that Pepperdine law review article that lets an independent be on the court if under certain circumstances, because I don't want to forego that possibility. I had a part of that proposal talking about how I had a fix for the idea that if a Republican died and we had a Democrat president, he would find a stealth Republican, you know, who was really a Democrat. I had a fix for that. So no one else agrees with this. But yes, I would like to see the Democrats end the filibuster, because they'd have to do that, convince Manchin somehow to go along with this. Add 3 seats to the court, make it 12. 3 Dems get on the court, it's 6-6. And then what they need to do is something like they did with the filibuster, which is the president obviously can send over anybody he or she wants to be nominated. That's her mm-hmm. constitutional prerogative. But as we've learned, the Senate doesn't have to take them. And the Senate should adopt a rule that when a Republican dies or retires, a Republican has to replace. If a Democrat dies or retires, then a Democrat has to be replaced once it's 12. And if it's independent, the independent is described the status of the political party of the person who died or retired. So I think that would all weaken the court. Life tenure should clearly be abolished. We don't need a constitutional amendment to do that. We could have Congress pass a law with fixed 18-year terms, and then the justices can sit as court of appeals judges or district court judges if they want. So they do have have to remain an Article III judge for life. They don't have to be a Supreme Court justice for life. Now, of course, I'd be in favor of abolishing life tenure for the lower courts, but that mathematically, you can't do it retroactively. And mathematically, that's very, very, very complicated. In the case of the Supreme Court, it's easy. You know, it's just nine. And again, can't be retroactive, but the next justice would have to be part of this new proposal. Interesting story about that. In 2011, I wrote a book about the Supreme Court, and I suggested most of these reforms, and I was laughed at the Legal Academy by 90% of it. And today, 60%, maybe 70% of the Legal Academy agrees with all the reforms that I suggested, including cameras in the court, which used to be incredibly unpopular, and now almost everybody agrees with cameras in the court. But I did write a piece in Salon a year ago or so, long piece, where I said the court needs to be reformed/weakened. There are a lot of ways to do it, jurisdiction stripping, all kinds of things. Democrats are doing it for the wrong reasons. They're doing it because now the court is all Republican, whatever, conservative. They should have been on board on this a long time ago.
Gotcha. Yeah, I definitely agree that the Supreme Court is too strong. And I really like your example with Hamilton. Building off of that, could you explain your argument for the clear error rule that you talk about in your book, Originalism as Faith? And if you want, you can also talk about Bork's famous law review.
Sure. When I'm on the radio, I often say this. I can't give a soundbite answer to that, so it's going to be a little bit long. But when the Constitution came out of Philadelphia in 1787 and went to the states for ratification, the people against the Constitution made a lot of arguments. One of which was, you can't give judges the power to veto laws. That's insane. It'll make judges, you know, the king, basically, because he who can veto has all the power, which is an overstatement. But the objection was, you know, obviously reasonable. So Hamilton responded to that. And he said, relax, relax. They won't be that powerful. They'll only overturn laws when there's an irreconcilable variance between the law and the Constitution. And they have neither purse nor sword, so they can't even enforce their own decisions and so on. We have a written Constitution where it's clear if somebody violates it, we need a third party to enforce that, because if Congress can decide Congress's own powers, then Congress's powers aren't limited. So I think Hamilton was right. Marshall was right in Marbury, that the structure of our Constitution suggests judicial review, but they both assumed judges would be humble. I mean, Marshall wasn't a humble guy, but he assumed judges would be humble. Judges would not strike down laws absent a clear variance, clear error. And the entire founding generation thought that. There were a couple of state court cases involving state charters and laws involving juries. One case is called the Prisoner's Case, very famous before the Constitution, but Oliver Ellsworth and all these famous people ended up being part of that case. And they all said, well, this whole thing about striking down laws, maybe we have to do that if they're inconsistent with the charter, but only when the error is clear. And even then we have to be humble and we have to do it, you know, in a very limited fashion. So that was the original idea. The Reconstruction Amendments didn't change that. The 14th Amendment clearly anticipates a major role for Congress, not for the courts, in enforcing it. Section 5 says that. Section 2 of the 15th says that. Aggressive judicial review, which began with Dred Scott and then continued on in the 1890s and then the Lochner era, is just simply inconsistent with the original meaning of the Constitution and Article III. But that's not why I'm for judicial deference. I'm for judicial deference because of modern reasons and my own value judgments about what elite life-tenured lawyers should and should not do. It just so happens that my modern-day value judgments about what the court should do is consistent with the original meaning of the Constitution, which is why whenever I'm at a meeting with originalists, I always tell them, modern day originalists, that since they don't agree with Bork, they don't agree with Raoul Berger, who argued for great deference, they don't argue for deference. I'm the only originalist in the room. It makes them crazy, and we go on.
I imagine that's a lot of fun. Building off of that and continuing to talk about originalism, Keith Whittington is one of my favorite professors, and he wrote a book about constitutional construction. Can you explain your issues or problems with constitutional construction, as some of the modern day originalists put it?
So I like Keith a lot. He's on my podcast next week. I know you've had him on yours. But Keith's not a lawyer. So I ministered to talk next week with Keith about his work in the 90s, because I think he unleashed something. He helped unleash something that I don't think he really believes today. But we'll find that out next week when I ask if we can get away from impeachment, which he's also an expert in. Listen. Randy Barnett, who with Keith came up with a constitutional construction interpretation distinction in the 90s, Randy and Evan Burnick, a young aspiring law professor who I've been trying to help get a job in the academy, because I really like Evan a lot. I brought him to Georgia State 2 years ago on my own dime. They wrote an article called a Unified Theory of Originalism, basically, and adopting explicitly the construction interpretation distinction. And they suggested that looking for the spirit of the Constitution when judges do constitutional construction is the way judges ought to go. And I wrote an article about their article saying their descriptive account of constitutional law was exactly accurate. It's perfect. I couldn't do better. It's just not originalism in any way. If you believe in constitutional construction, and these originalists do, what they're saying is where the meaning of the Constitution is unclear, the original meaning, which is virtually every constitutional case ever, then judges have to use other value judgments to construct the meaning. And that's true. Everything we know about free speech law, except for the ban on prior restraints, is constitutional construction made up by the justices. It might be right, it might be wrong. It is not the original meaning of the First Amendment. Judd Campbell, my friend at Richmond, wrote an article in Yale about that. He's 100% right. The founding fathers viewed free speech as a natural law right, but they didn't view natural law rights as judicially enforceable. So this is all constitutional construction. So Jack Balkin says it best, and I'm on this very nerdy con law list, full of law professors, and we were having a debate about constitutional construction and originalism and living constitutionalism, and Jack, who very rarely comes to this, did swoop in and say, look, what's happening is living originalism, that's the name of his book, what's happening is living originalism, and he's right, but let's be clear. And I've said this to Jack many times. Living originalism and living constitutionalism are the same thing. And if you're a new originalist who believes in the construction interpretation distinction, then you are in fact as much a living constitutionalist as a originalist. Let me finish by saying this. Both Professor Larry Solomon at Virginia now, who is also one of the architects of all of this, and my friend Ilya Soman at George Mason, who considers himself an originalist in some way. Both of them have written, and also Elan Werman, who's been on your podcast from Arizona, this young, an up-and-coming originalist, who wrote a book on originalism. They all have said, all of them, that where we know the original meaning and where we know how the original meaning would be applied to a particular situation, like gender discrimination in 1868, which we know wasn't covered by the 14th Amendment. If you look at the meaning of it, the original meaning, all three have said that constitutional law has to evolve as facts and circumstances change. And Solemn even said, not just facts change, views about facts change, which is not the same as facts changing. It's views about facts changing. Well, once you allow judges to do that, which judges do, I agree, then you're not an originalist. You're a living constitutionalist. Move on. Not you, them.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, but you stole it from me.
Sorry.
So I'll go to the next question. The first professor that I actually got to know is Professor Blackman. And something he said struck me. And he said, there's never been a truly originalist justice on the court. So how has originalism in theory or in practice been misapplied or not applied at all?
Hold on, back up. Are you talking about Josh Blackman?
Yes.
And Professor Josh Blackman said to you, there's never been an originalist on the Supreme Court?
Truly and fully. I mean, I guess I would assume that in many or some of the cases, he would believe that justices were following the original meaning, of course, but not in a consistent manner throughout their career, I believe. Man. Yes.
Well, good for Josh. He's never said that publicly, I don't think, and I wish he would. There has never been an originalist justice on the Supreme Court. My book really does go through that. It doesn't go through every justice ever, obviously, but it makes the case for it. There is an entire chapter showing neither Scalia nor Thomas are originalists, and I have a mountain of data for that argument. And Gorsuch has now at least three times, maybe four, voted clearly in a non-originalist fashion. The Janus case involving union dues, there is no argument, none, that the original meaning of the First Amendment, either in 1789 or 1868, that paying dues was speech, period, full stop. No originalist argument. That's Janus. Trinity Lutheran and Montana Department of Revenue, same thing. There are no originalist arguments supporting those cases. Gorsuch joined both of them. And in the Baker case, the Colorado Baker, Gorsuch wrote a separate opinion about free speech in that case. And again, there's no originalist argument for that. So if Scalia, Thomas, and Gorsuch aren't originalists, you know, then we're kind of done, right?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I think Rehnquist was closer. I think Rehnquist, he wasn't either.
Really?
Rehnquist was closer in the sense that there's a legitimate, I'm not saying it's persuasive, legitimate argument about the relationship between the states and federal government that I think Rehnquist had correct. So Rehnquist saw First Amendment cases, especially campaign finance cases, but others, through that originalist lens, that this idea of robust free speech didn't really apply to state law so much. That's a more honest assessment of the First Amendment than anything Scalia and Thomas and Gorsuch have ever suggested.
Gotcha. On the same topic of constraining and weakening the Supreme Court, if an originalist jurisprudence or jurisprudence in general was limited to original expected applications or the paradigm reason for a constitutional provision's existence, so like disqualifying stuff like applying the First Amendment to the internet and whatnot, and as Professor Werman said, applying the old provisions to new and evolving values and whatnot, would you be supportive of this more constrained jurisprudence?
Well, I'm not trying to start the question. The First Amendment does apply to the internet. There's no question about it. How it applies to the internet is a modern question, not an originalist question, obviously, because there's nothing in 17. I mean, Orrin Kerr just wrote a great article about one particular, Fourth Amendment issue that in the digital age, where there was a similar case a long, long time ago. But that's the exception. We don't know anything. The original meaning of the Constitution in 1789 or 1868 won't tell us anything about, for example, my argument that I made on Dorf on Law 2 days ago, that the imminence requirement of Brandenburg, which in the free speech about incitement, which in 1968, in the context of a Ku Klux Klan rally, made a lot of sense, but in the context of 2021 in the internet, makes no sense at all. But here's the thing. In my view of deference, the courts should not strike down any law unless either it's clearly inconsistent with the unambiguous text of the Constitution, or what Jed Rubenfeld, who I know has fallen out of grace for personal reasons, but once of Yale, but once, I mean, he'd done some bad stuff with women, but he once wrote an article, what he called paradigm cases. And I think that's exactly right. So in the First Amendment context, the paradigm case is prior restraints. Doesn't say it, but every historian agrees. that, or almost every historian, that the basis, the idea behind the First Amendment was that the, you know, England was stopping printing presses from printing stuff prior to approval from the crown or the parliament or whatever. And we can't have prior restraints. The First Amendment was not about punishing. It was not about stopping the punishment of speech. It was about stopping prior restraints. So that's the paradigm case.
Gotcha.
The paradigm case of the 14th Amendment is racial discrimination, even though it doesn't say that. And it's racial discrimination against African-Americans, not against whites. That's the paradigm case.
Yeah, a lot of the problem with the Supreme Court becoming too powerful in my mind is that they have to stretch out these provisions to new and different things that they weren't intended for. And so building on top of that, I remember Justice Scalia said that he would be in favor of making the amendment process easier, as obviously we haven't had one for a few decades. And we haven't had that money across our history, if you count out all the amendments at the start with the Bill of Rights. So would you be in favor of making the amendment process easier?
Yes, 100%. The reason the Supreme Court has to do all this work is because of that.
And then building on top of that, another reason, obviously, is Congress. I think most people can agree, has become more and more inept. How much of the problems with the court do you think would go away if Congress became engaged and started legislating and filling its role in our constitutional system again?
I don't accept the premise. I think Congress has been inept forever. The musical 1776 says it well. Piddle, twiddle, and resolve, not one damn thing do we solve, is what John Adams said, in the musical anyway. I think it's just a line, not a historical thing, to be clear, but it does capture, I think, what was going on. There was a long time when the Congress was paralyzed by filibusters against the Civil Rights Act, like 58 to 63. The Congress didn't do very much because it was paralyzed with filibusters and all that. The Congress of 1876 was pretty incompetent, and so on and so forth. So I don't accept the premise. I do think it's the other way around. I think if the court would stop interfering, Congress would get better.
Gotcha. Now, after Justice Barrett's confirmation, there's a 6-3 majority of conservatives on the court. So what do you think in the next few years the court's jurisprudence is going to look like now that Roberts can't rein in as much as he was used to?
Gun rights will go up. Roe and Casey will be gutted, then overruled, unless the dynamics on the court change. The court will continue on its, this is never talked about, but it's really important, unconscionable interpretations of the Federal Arbitration Act, using it in a Lochner type way to do things it was never intended to do. The court is going to privilege religious rights over LGBTQ rights in unconscionable fashion. The court has already unconscionably ruled that states have to fund private religious schools if they fund secular schools, and that idea is going to spread to other places. Again, unconscionable, inconsistent with text history. It's just the justices making shit up. Excuse me. It's going to be they're going to keep Lochnerizing through the First Amendment. They're going to cut back on delegations to executive agencies and pretend somehow that's not enlarging the court's own power, which it is, and all kinds of other dastardly things. And then they'll throw in a good. And then they might throw in a liberal decision here and there, to so they can pound their chest and say, "See, it's not all politics."
Personally, for me, I would like the court to strike down Roe and Casey, but I'm feeling pretty pessimistic about that. Obviously, there was June Medical last term, and Justice Thomas had a pretty fiery dissent where he talks directly about those two cases. And what was remarkable to me is that nobody, not a single justice signed on to that dissent, although others penned their own dissents. And I mean, there has always been a fear about those specific cases getting struck down, going all the way back to Bork, but it still hasn't happened. Do you think I'm being too pessimistic and that what I actually want might happen?
I would ask you, so Barrett, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, which of those five are not going to vote to overrule Roe and Casey? I think Roberts will too, but eventually. But which of those won't? I mean, first of all, Thomas and Alito are on record as saying they'd overturn Roe and Casey. So those two are already there. Barrett obviously is going to rule that way. Maybe Gorsuch won't. I guess it's possible, but I think Roberts will too. So I remember Roberts's wife was head of Feminists for Life. And that's not, I don't mean Feminists for Life. You know, it's not Feminists for Life. It's Feminists for Life. What Roberts will do, and this is why he's already done it. This is why he wrote his concurring opinion in June Medical, which is actually the controlling opinion. He weakened the test. Mm-hmm. And he's going to keep doing that for a while. And then he'll show, see, the doctrine has been weakened, and then they'll overturn it. It's what he did with the Voting Rights Act. It's what he did with Janus and Union. I mean, he went along with, you know, Alito did it, but Roberts went along with the dues. The writing's on the wall here. Don't worry about it from your perspective. By the way, I'm pro-choice all the way down. People know that. I mm-hmm. worked for Planned Parenthood, met my wife when I gave a speech to Planned Parenthood, changed my life forever for the better. I think I want Roe and Casey overturned also. The one reason because I think that for a lot of conflict, I've been through this before on many podcasts, but let me just say the one possibility that Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and maybe Roberts, although I doubt it, but the one possibility that Kavanaugh and Gorsuch won't vote to overturn Roe and Casey is that their allegiance is to the Republican Party. I mean, Gorsuch's mother was a Republican, head of the EPA. Kavanaugh, his entire life was for the Republican Party. And they both know overturning Roe and Casey would really damage the Republican Party's fundraising efforts and vote. So if they choose Republican Party politics over anything else, which they might, I don't know if they will or not, then they may not overturn Roe and Casey. Yesterday, I was talking to a very progressive colleague of mine about court reform and weakening the court and all that stuff. And he said, politically, you can't do that until Roe and Casey are overturned, which is the flip side of what I'm saying. He was saying Democrats cannot weaken the court because that'll be viewed as taking away from the court the ability to overturn Roe and Casey. And so that's the flip side. In some ways, Republicans need Roe and Casey. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's an interesting formulation. And I'm pretty sympathetic because, I mean, the whole reason I originally got into con law and whatnot is, of course, because Justice Scalia was the most outspoken on abortion and whatnot. I got interested in due process and substantive due process. And then eventually that just grew into me being interested in the court. In general, but I can't deny that the origins of that was abortion.
Well, can I ask you a question then? Mm-hmm. Can we reverse roles for a minute? Because I'm genuinely curious. So I've written three pieces on Dorf on Law about talking about abortion and why Americans can't talk about abortion. When I talk or meet with people who are what they self-identify as pro-life, I call them anti-choice, but either way, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say to them, I'm sympathetic to your position. I mean, if you think fetuses are humans and you think this is murder, I'm not going to say, I can't say you're wrong. You know, it's a value judgment. It's an idea. I mean, fetuses are life. That's a fact. That's not an opinion. That's a fact. But whether they're human life is a value judgment.
Yeah.
But so my question to you is this. And I think this question is everything, by the way. This question is everything. This is the whole thing right here. There's no way to stop abortions. No country's ever been able to stop abortions. We will never stop abortions. There were millions and millions of abortions before Roe and Casey. So by making, what do you want to have? If abortion is illegal, what happens next? Are you going to put women in jail who have abortions? Are you going to put doctors in jail who do abortions? And it's not as a kind of, not as a what the justice should do, but as a pure policy matter for legislatures, because I would like to see legislatures handle this. I would, like you, I think it should be returned to the states and, you know, whatever. But when talking about voting for a law, pro or con, A, what do you do with women and doctors? And B, you have to admit you can't stop abortions. Like, I, especially in an era with abortion pills. Like, there's always been abortions, even without abortion pills. So what are you trying to accomplish exactly?
Well, I think first, obviously, the first step is bringing it back to the states. And obviously, it's culturally acceptable. And as you said, a ton of people don't view it as a human life with value. So their intent isn't to murder. They just, they don't assert or impugn value to it.
Sorry. Impugn value is a weird way to put that. I think there are women who get pregnant who don't want to get pregnant. And then they balance all the problems of bringing an unwanted child or the way to, or having an unexpected pregnancy. Now they have a choice. And it's not that there's no value. I meet very few people who say that. What they say is, I can't live my life in an equal way and I can't feed my other kids or my whatever if I had this child. So I'm having no value is not a way I would put that for most people. So.
Okay, that's fair. The way I would say it then is, like, to me, no matter what, if it's a human life and whatnot, I want to go into balancing the pros and cons of it. That's just a simple way I'd put. But in terms of jailing doctors and women who do it, I don't think that's feasible for a long time, or maybe ever. If it was to ever happen, you need to have it where it's much more of a universal stigma than it currently is. But I really don't like the point on abortions will always exist, because I mean, that's true of many things, like murder will always exist. And I take the point fairly that it'll be widespread. And obviously you can ship things across state lines like abortion pills and whatnot. So even if it gets banned in some states, it'll still be easy for many people to still get an abortion. But that line of argument, it's not effective to me, because there's many things that we can try and restrict and whatnot, but we're obviously never going to be able to fully restrict. So I guess those would be my responses.
Well, so on the last one, and this is what I talked about a little bit on those three Dorfman Law pieces, but not as much as I should have. On that last point, when you said, of course, there'll be murders, but, you know, we still have to outlaw murder. Fair. There'll always be arsonists. There'll always be domestic abusers and so on. You know, domestic abuse has gone unpunished in this country, you know, in a big way for ever. We still outlaw it correctly. But there's a difference. Luke, there really is a difference. Everybody agrees murder should be illegal. Everybody. I mean, I hope, agrees domestic abuse should be illegal. Everybody agrees arson should be illegal. 50% of America doesn't think abortion should be illegal. So that difference is everything. It really is. So your point about stigma is fair, but we're a long way off from any kind of consensus about abortion. So my question remains, what are you fighting for? I'm not talking about the Supreme Court. I agree with you. The Supreme Court should return to the states. But now we're in the legislature. And I suspect you want to outlaw abortions. But to what end is my question? Because it won't outlaw abortions. You don't have the stomach for jailing women and doctors. Making it harder only impacts the poor. You know the middle class and rich women will always be able to get abortions. So in fact, it's the worst of all worlds. The people with the most resources don't bring unwanted children into the world. And the people with least resources have to bring unwanted children into the world. Why? For what end? That's just, you know.
Yeah, just morally, I think it's imperative to continue to the point where it is a universal stigma. And obviously, I agree with you that the end is not in foresight with there. And I know somebody would, like you would hate this comparison, but to me, the most apt comparison is slavery from my point of view. And you could look at the founding or anywhere before it was abolished after the Civil War. And there's a lot of similarities, obviously, of course. There's a lot of differences. But I mean, that was a question that sharply divided the question or the country. And it took a long time. But that's a comparison, I guess I would
right.
make.
Right. And so I once wrote a piece for the Huffington Post, I think it was Huffington Post, about libertarians in America should really, if they're consistent with their libertarian principles, be pro-choice, not because they have to agree abortion isn't murder. No, you can still say abortion's murder, but what they have to agree with is the data, which shows that 50% of America doesn't think that. And if you're a libertarian, you should only want government interference when there's, you know, when there's a consensus that government needs to interfere. And there is no consensus in America that government needs to interfere. Now, the response to that was exactly what you just said. Same thing about slavery. And slavery in 1850. This may not be true, but it's like half of America was for it, half was against it. Mm-hmm. So libertarians back then, you know, would have to say government can't stop you from owning a slave because 50% of America thinks you should be able to own a slave. It supports your point about slavery and abortion. My only answer, so it's a good point. My response, which is tentative though, is reasonable people cannot disagree about, and really couldn't then, whether slaves were humans. It was just, I know there's a lot of rhetoric that they weren't, mm-hmm. but everybody knew they were humans. It was more an issue of what kind of human they were. And maybe that's true about a fetus that can't live and breathe on its own, but it strikes me as very different.
Yeah, I think you summed it up right, the fundamental question. And going on to this, and this is something I'm genuinely excited for, you briefly mentioned some of the recent free exercise cases with Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza. Why is Espinoza and Trinity Lutheran so problematic in your mind?
Yeah, they're really awful. I mean, they're as bad as they come. I worked for the first George Bush in the Department of Justice. And I was very lucky. I had a lot of constitutional cases. Not everybody I was in the federal programs branch. Not everybody did, but I did. And the case I spent the most time on was a parochial school aid case. So back then, the Supreme Court had these completely incoherent and arbitrary rules about what kind of aid state and federal governments could give to religious schools. And it was crazy. It's just nuts. You could give books, but that's it. So you couldn't give maps. So someone once said, what about an atlas? You can give the map if you tear it out of the atlas. I'm sorry, you can give the atlas, but if you tear the map out of it, you can't give it to students, which was in fact a law. It's crazy. And I eventually wrote a law review article saying, this is nuts. Aid that is secular, not Bibles and Torahs, but aid, you know, non-religious content stuff like, you know, erasers, chalk, computers, whatever. That if a state wants to give that aid generally to all students in schools, wherever they are, public, private, non-religious, and private religious, the First Amendment has nothing to say about that. It's not an establishment of religion. It's just accessible aid to help all kids. The United States Catholic Conference intervened in my case. And the lawyer for the United States Catholic Conference, a man named Charlie Wilson, who was Justice Warren's law clerk, actually wrote the Flass versus Cohen decision. I mean, my friend wrote it. Warren, you know, put his name on it. He was the lawyer for the U.S. Catholic Conference. Nobody thought the free exercise clause required the states to give aid. The only issue was, what does the Establishment Clause prohibit states from giving aid? And the idea that the state of Montana, plus like 30 other states, I think it was, or something, but let's just talk about Montana. Montana said, we want to give some aid to parents of secular private schools for all kinds of reasons I don't agree with. But nevertheless, Montana is clearly allowed to do that. Then they said, more or less, we don't want to extend this to religious schools. This is Montana. This is not New York. This is not California. This is not even Michigan and Wisconsin. This is freaking Montana. Montana says, we're concerned about the entanglement / establishment clause / no problems when we give aid to religious schools. And we want to avoid that intermixing of government and religion. There's nothing in the history of the free exercise clause that says Montana can't do that. Nothing. Trinity Lutheran came out of nowhere. Espinoza comes out of nowhere. They cite no originalist materials because they can't. And there are originalists who say, if you go back, and when Trinity came out, I think it was Mike Ramsey at San Diego, who's a friend of mine, and runs the originalism blog, for goodness sake. He runs the originalism blog at the school that has the largest originalism center, and so on and so forth. And even he said that Trinity Lutheran and Janus both don't have originalist, you know, underpinnings. They don't. It's ridiculous. And let's talk federalism for a minute. On paper, over 30 states had the same rule Montana did. Now, in practice, many did not. But on paper, they did. What are we doing here? What are we doing with these lawyers in D.C. making crap up that 36 states disagree with? It's not in the text. It's not in the history. And it's absurd. Montana wants to help its kids. It doesn't want to mix itself in with religion. All right, fine. Now, if voters don't want to do that, that's fine. But they did. It's crazy. It's nuts. It's wrong. And by the way, it's judicial aggression of the very worst kind.
All right, well, I'm gonna push you on this. So to be fair on Montana, I feel like if the current legislature could, they would make it general. But obviously it was their tax department or whatever that when they looked at their state constitution and they looked at when they readopted it in the 1970s, they couldn't give aid to sectarian schools and whatnot. If it's generally neutral, and there's plenty of other free exercise cases, let's say if the aid is flowing to the school through the private choice of a third party, that was in V. Simmons Harris, that it can't implicate the establishment clause.
Those are establishment clause cases, not free exercise cases.
Yeah, so I guess my question would be then, what possible entanglement concern could they have if previous Supreme Court jurisprudence?
Well, here's one. Every private school in Montana is Christian. There are no Jewish private schools there. There are no Muslim private schools there. And so making aid available to religious schools in Montana means making it available to Christian schools only. And it's a perfectly legitimate value judgment to say the optics of that are bad. It is divisive. It's not something we want to do. And by the way, it is completely consistent with the United States Constitution for a state to decide on its own. They don't have to decide this under the Establishment Clause. They don't. Now, progressives would disagree with me on that, but I'm clear on that. If the states want to give the aid, they can give the aid. That's what I litigated. But they could also say, we don't want any tax dollars going to fund the religious activities of private schools. Once you give money to religious schools, the money can be used for anything. So, and now, when I litigated those Establishment Clause cases, The United States Catholic Conference urged all of its schools, and we're talking about like 15 different Supreme Court cases here, to strongly argue that they teach math and social studies, et cetera, in a non-sectarian, secular way. So giving us aid for math doesn't aid the religious mission of the schools. Now, in the free exercise context, and other that they've argued, no, we can't separate it out. We even teach math in a religious way. That change only occurred because of the personnel in the Supreme Court, which is crazy. But my real point here is a state is allowed to say our tax dollars aren't going to go to the religious mission of religious schools. That's how we read. That's our interpretation of the Establishment Clause. And they're allowed to do that. There's nothing to stop. If you believe in states' rights, what's wrong with that? The perfectly fine value judgment. Everson said it. There were 25 cases in the 70s and 80s that said it. I don't believe it, by the way. I'm not suggesting it's true. I'm just suggesting it's a reasonable interpretation of the Establishment Clause. That's all.
All right. I'll just have to agree to disagree on that one.
Okay. Well, wait a second. Why isn't it a reasonable interpretation of the Establishment Clause?
The Establishment Clause is really important because in Locke v. Davy and whatnot, if they wanted to, the college student could have gone to purely religious classes and whatnot. And so the money from the Washington Scholarship Fund could have flowed entirely towards a religious purpose. And you actually stole another one of my questions when you mentioned that Montana schools are Christian, because when I was researching, that was something I did find out, because one would think that some of the money for private schools would go to secular and then some would go to sectarian or religious ones, but that wasn't the case.
My point though about that wasn't that there are, hold on. My point wasn't that all the private schools are Christian and therefore there are no non-religious private schools. That wasn't my point. My point is all the religious schools are Christian. So the legislature of Montana could reasonably say, when we send tax dollars to private schools in this state, that means we're sending money to Christian schools. Now, we're allowed to do that under the Establishment Clause. We are. We're allowed. But we don't want to do it. And why? So what's our legitimate interest in not doing it? We don't want the optics of tax money supporting one religion and one religion only. Now, you can disagree with that value judgment, but to say it's constitutionally prohibited, well, that's constitutional construction run amok, because it's not constitutionally prohibited. Nothing in the text or history of the First Amendment says the state of Montana can't say, we don't want the optics of tax money going only to Christian schools.
Gotcha. Well, then what would you say quickly, and then after this, we can wrap up the optics of if you're going to have generally neutral programs, but then you're going to exclude religious people, it's treating them as second class citizens. And I forget who was representing them in front of the Supreme Court, but they tried to draw the comparison to segregation in the South. There's some problems with that. I didn't really agree with that comparison, but the question still stands. How are they not being treated as, if we remove the entanglement concerns for a second, how are they not being treated?
Right, it's a great question. I think it was Institute for Justice or Pacific Legal Foundation or one of those, organizations that litigated. First of all, it's not segregation. It's nothing to do with segregation.
Yeah.
All right. So obviously I would hold unconstitutional a law that says we'll provide police and fire protection, but not for churches. Like, I would find that to be unconstitutional discrimination. Why is that different than schools? And the answer to that, I think, is when a church is on fire, when a church is being broken into by thugs, whatever, there's nothing religious about that. Nothing. I mean, it's the victims of crimes, and police and fire departments need to respond to those victims of crimes like they would any other victims of crimes. And I can't think of any institution that would be exempt from that. Leaving, you know, under the Equal Protection Clause, there'd be no rational basis, forgetting anything about religion. So that takes care of churches, and that takes care of police and fire protection. There is an idea that is as old as this country, that tax dollars shouldn't support religion. That idea, we can debate whether it's a good idea. It's as old as this country. So when legislators get together and debate this, some will say what you said. It's unfair to exclude religious schools from these generally available benefits. Others will say no. For example, in Montana, Jews and Muslims who don't have enough people here, there are some, but they don't have enough people to have a school, would say, don't use my tax dollars to support the teaching of Jesus. That's wrong. And when you give money to private Christian schools, you are giving them money to teach about Jesus. That disagreement is a value judgment disagreement. No one's right or wrong. It's like, is Godfather 1 better than Godfather 2? Mm-hmm. Or in Posner's language,
it's Godfather 1 is better.
It's whether a cosmopolitan is better than a margarita or vice versa. Those are value judgments. And you know what else? You know what Scalia said about value judgments in Casey? They should be voted on, not mandated by people from above. So the value judgment that tax dollars shouldn't support religious activities is a legitimate value judgment. That's the answer to your question.
I must say, you leave me a little confused then why you are so opposed to Trinity Lutheran, because the funds in that case were going to repurposing the playground and tire scraps and whatnot. And if somebody makes an argument that that is not helping the religious mission of the school, is that at all convincing to you? Because that was the distinction they tried to make.
If you read my work on this, I said Trinity Lutheran was a truly hard case. Because Trinity Lutheran is not police and fire protection, right? But it's not books and maps and equipment that relieves private schools of that obligation so they can spend more on teaching Jesus. It's right in the middle. And having safe playgrounds is a good thing. No, for kids. I want all the kids in Missouri, to have a safe playground. So I think it's a really hard case. On that basis. So my objection to Trinity Lutheran is, I have two objections. One is, if you come out that it's rightly decided, it's not originalism. So let's just forget that. It's constitutional construction, admit it. That's fine. Our world is full of that. Trinity Lutheran is no better or worse than other cases on that, but don't pretend it's originalist. So when Gorsuch signs on to it, don't pretend he's an originalist. My second objection is more powerful. The case was obviously, clearly, not an Article III case of controversy by the time it got to the Supreme Court. The governor of Missouri said, from now on, religious schools get this money. There was no evidence that was going to change. The case was moot. And just saying the voluntary cessation of illegal conduct does not moot a case, that's a soundbite. It doesn't address what I'm talking about, which is there was no adversarialness at all. Everybody in the case agreed on everything. And by the way, it's the only case in Supreme Court history where both parties agreed on the merits and on the mootness question. In other cases where the court said voluntary cessation of illegal conduct doesn't moot a case, one of the parties was saying this case the parties disagreed on mootness. One party said yes, one party said no. In this case, both people said no to mootness and yes to the merits. There was no adversarialness on any issue in the case.
All right. Well, with that, I think we can wrap it up. So my last question of the day, if somebody's trying to learn more about constitutional law, what are three books you'd recommend them to read besides your own, of course?
Okay. I got to think about that. That's a question I have to think about. If you just want the black letter law, just the facts, ma'am. I think Chemerinsky's treatise is very good. Now, Uren is a progressive and he's written, but in that treatise, he tries to set forth the black letter law. He sometimes gives opinions about the black letter law afterwards, but he's very good at making that distinction. So if you just want the black letter law of constitutional law, Erwin Chemerinsky's treatise is very good. I wouldn't, you know, his articles and essays are written from a progressive standpoint, but the treatise is not bad in terms of being neutral. That's one book. I actually think this is going to kill me, but Jack Balkin's Living Originalism is the most accurate description of constitutional law in this country I've ever read. It just has the wrong label. And I've said that to him countless times. I love your book. It has the worst title in history because there's nothing originalist about what you're writing about. But I would really recommend Living Originalism for those who want an accurate description other than the label of what constitutional law is in this country. You said three. It's not a book, but Michael McConnell's early articles, 1970s articles on judicial review, where he talks about the importance of humility and modesty on judges, they influenced me a lot. And I think they're great. Bunch of articles.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving your time, Professor.